we think of our actions as, you know, drops of water. You know, that one drop of water seems insignificant. You know, each action does seem insignificant on its own. And it's when you look back and realize all the people that are around you that are putting their drops of water in the bucket, and you realize that, okay, together, that's how we're making change. That's how things move forward.
It's easy to talk about the successes, but what doesn't get talked about enough is the struggle. My name is Eric Weinmayer. I've gotten the chance to ascend Mount Everest, to climb the tallest mountain in every continent, to kayak the Grand Canyon, and I happen to be blind. It's been a struggle to live what I call a no barriers life, to define it, to push the parameters of what it means. And part of the equation is diving into the learning process, this process of growth and change and transformation that we're all a part of, and trying to illuminate the universal elements that exist along the way, like holds on a rock face that lead us forward and give us clues to why it's so important we get there. In that unexplored terrain, between those dark places we find ourselves in the summit, exists a map. That map, that way forward, is what we call no barriers.
Today we meet Shannon Galpin, an author, artist, global women's rights activist, film producer, and a National Geographic Adventurer of the Year. She spent a decade working on humanitarian projects in Afghanistan, including creating the groundbreaking street art project, Streets of Afghanistan. She's a producer on the feature documentary, Afghan Cycles, and has published two books, including her memoir, Mountain to Mountain. Shannon was awarded an honorary diploma by the International Olympic Committee for her work promoting women's equality through sports, and is a fellow of the Explorers Club. Above all else, Shannon is a mother, and she's determined to raise her daughter to use her voice for those that don't have one. Welcome, everybody, to our No Barriers podcast. This is David Cherna, executive director and one of the founders of No Barriers. Thrilled to have you join us here with Eric Weinmayer and Jeff Evans. We have a wonderful show for you today. Before we get started and introduce you to our guest, Eric, you just recently had a pretty cool kayak experience in an unusual location for the kind of stuff that we do. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. We have our No Barriers Summit every year. It's a really big gathering where we all celebrate this No Barriers life together. And we're doing it in New York City. So we went to New York to do a little pre-publicity. And just for the fun of it, my teammate and I kayaked around Manhattan Island. It was almost 30 miles. And it was a really cool urban adventure, kayaking down the Hudson and around the Statue of Liberty and under the Brooklyn Bridge. I could hear it roaring above. And you have this dense city thrumming, you know, just to your side. And you're in this beautiful river. It was a cool adventure. So about 8 hours later, we came back around the corner and down the Hudson and back to the aircraft carrier, the Intrepid, which is the site of the No Barrier Summit. So it was really special to do that.
What is scarier, kayaking the full length of the Grand Canyon or trying to navigate the streets of New York City?
There were scary barges and cruise lines and cruise ships and, you know, so there was a lot of boat traffic you had to definitely avoid. And then the water, probably you wouldn't really want to drink it.
Some flotsam and jetsam.
And Skylar said at one point a turd was floating by, but I chose to believe it was a turtle. Turtle. I translated it in my mind. So, yeah, maybe not the cleanest waterway, but it was just an amazing urban adventure.
Oh, dude. You just Baby Ruth the podcast.
Well, anyway, with that, let's start. But we have an amazing guest with us, Shannon Galpin, and she is an activist and an author and a film producer and an adventure, National Geographic Adventure of the Year, fellow in the Explorers Club. Just we're really honored to have you here, and you're a local Coloradan, so it's nice to sit here with you.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here with you all.
So on your website, in doing some research, I saw that you call yourself and your group endangered activists. So what does that mean? Why do you think activism's maybe becoming endangered in the world?
This started with my daughter, who's 13 now, because she wanted me to stop working in Afghanistan, where I've been working for the past decade. And she is passionate about wildlife conservation and truly was upset about the fact that young people don't seem to have a voice, or when they use it, adults don't listen. And I have constantly worked in the world combating apathy and trying to promote that activism is not a dirty word. And so we started brainstorming, and I decided that I would step back a little bit from my work in Afghanistan, not quit, but just, you know, kind of pull a little bit back and start mentoring her in what her passion was and teach her how to build a project or an organization around what she cared about. And literally within an hour or two of discussing it, we came up with the name Endangered Activism based on her passion for endangered species, my passion for combating apathy and trying to promote activism, and the idea that perhaps activism is also an endangered species. And she agreed with me, luckily, because she's kind of the boss in this particular project. So Endangered Activism was born in a coffee shop in Breckenridge a couple of years ago as a mother-daughter collaboration.
So this, I love this concept of combating apathy. Talk to us about why. What are some of the causes in your mind of that apathy? You know, we have a world today that has so much information and so much access to all the problems that need to be fought for. And so what in your mind, where's that apathy coming from?
I think it's exactly because of having too much information, and it's assaulting us, you know, kind of from all sides. We're never getting a break from the news constantly being streamed at us. And I think the people that I know that are wanting to do good in the world, but now feel almost frozen. And it's because they feel that it's so overwhelming that instead of plugging in and getting engaged and feeling like, okay, there's so much going on, I need to get engaged, I need to be part of the solution. And what can I do in my community? Or, you know, what can I join? How do I community activate? Instead, they become apathetic and they actually kind of hunker down, pull in, and close the blinds because it's just too much. And I get it. It's kind of like sensory overload. And I think that what I've tried to stress over the years has been the idea that every individual can make a difference. And that literally, if we think of our actions as, you know, drops of water, you know, that it isn't, you know, that one drop of water seems insignificant. You know, each action does seem insignificant on its own. And I constantly feel insignificant with what I do in the world and how I act in the world. And then it's when you look back and realize all the people that are around you that are putting their drops of water in the bucket, and you realize that, okay, together, that's how we're making change. That's how things move forward. But it's hard to break through that apathy. And I think that the best way to re-engage those same people is through storytelling. And that's kind of the universal in which all of my work through the last couple of decades has been. No matter how different my projects have seemed, they've all come back to voice and the power of voice and storytelling.
I love how you, it sounds as though your daughter was sort of a catalyst for this new, the sort of optic that you use now for what you've done for years, right?
And you, exactly.
Yeah, I have a 13-year-old son, so I get that age. It's like it's just blossoming. It's still a little innocent, right? But she somehow has, you know, brought out this other opportunity, really, and for you two to be together. So my question for you is, can you back up the story just a little bit? And you've got, I mean, if you had a business card, you'd have like 15 bullet points on it, right? So, I mean, I know it's probably tough to distill it down, but I mean, if you can give us an idea of how this point in time came to be with activism, with writing books, with starting, you know, mountain biking coalitions. I mean, there's a lot that's going on. So give us that story that leads us here.
Well, looking backwards now, it makes perfect sense. And you know, it's like I look backwards at this very circuitous route that led me here, and it's like someone kind of, you know, sprinkled breadcrumbs like Hansel and Gretel. It totally makes sense, although the path here involves me graduating from high school a year early and thinking I was going to be a dancer, and being raped and nearly killed when I was 18, to quitting dance, to becoming a sports therapist, hoping to work with dancers, but then I moved to Europe and stayed in Europe for 10 years and worked with rugby players. You know, it's not linear in any way. But if that's like the fast version, after 10 years in Europe, I moved back to Colorado. And that's kind of where we're at now starts. Because I moved back to Colorado with my then husband, and about a year and a half later, I was pregnant with my now daughter. And my only sister, who's 10 years younger than me, which was the main reason I had moved back from Europe, was because she was graduating high school. She was at college, and she was a campus rape. And everything I thought I knew at that point just went upside down. Because my own attack had not necessarily defined the way I lived my life, or so I thought. I had, that had happened. I recovered and I moved on, but I had never talked about it with anyone. No one knew about it at all.
Not one soul on the planet knew.
Not one soul on the planet.
Yeah.
No.
Not even your sister.
No, mm-hmm. Particularly not my sister, which at that point then when I found out about my sisters, inherently had a lot of guilt. But at the time that it happened, she would have only been like 8 or 9 years old. So, of course, you're not going to have that conversation. And so then time passes. You never come back to having that conversation because you've never had that conversation. And basically the same sort of thing happens to her. While I'm getting ready to raise a new female and bring her into the world. And I remember thinking that my parents had 2 kids, both daughters, 10 years apart, what were the odds that this could happen to them? 2 different states, completely different situations. And I started just a random Google search and discovered that the odds are really bad, really, really bad for women. And that led me down a path that I changed my career as a sports trainer and became almost overnight a women's rights activist. Inherently, the activism is always in me. I'm outspoken and blunt and very opinionated, and but I wasn't putting that into use in the world in a, you know, certainly a coherent way. And I started researching, you know, what were the worst places in the world to be a woman, and Afghanistan was at the top of the list.
So you went there.
So I went there.
So
as
much
you do.
For apathy.
Mm-hmm.
So much for apathy.
So much for apathy, exactly. That is at least the one word. I can be defined by a lot of words, but apathetic is not one of them, I'm proud to say. So I literally dove straight in. And I think that one of my better qualities is that I thrive in the deep end. I'm not uncomfortable being out of my depth. It doesn't scare me. And I kind of like it. I like the puzzle of figuring things out. And I've always worked for myself. I've never had a boss. So the idea of becoming an activist was just another puzzle to figure out. And it was just another organization to create.
But also cracking the code of Afghanistan, just like as a civilian, right? Just moving there. And how the heck do you get there? And how do you navigate? And the fear, the danger, right? Most people would find that a huge barrier.
Yeah, I think you're exactly correct. When I, at the time, this is about 10 or 11 years ago, you know, you start looking at the websites, and you can't Travelocity your way to Afghanistan at the time. You can now, but certainly, you know, 10, 11 years ago, you couldn't. And so I reached out to a friend who was a photographer that I knew who had worked in Afghanistan and just asked, is there any way that you would sit down with me and share whatever insight you have. She had an amazing fixer and translator in Kabul who she said she trusted with her life. Therefore, I trusted him with mine, and he was willing to work with me. Bought a ticket through a travel agent and showed up hoping against hope that he would be there at the airport in Kabul with a little white sign that had my name on it. And lo and behold, he was. And 25 trips to Afghanistan later, we're still friends. We still work together. And I was able slowly over those initial trips to learn. My goal was not to go in there as the white savior thinking I know everything. My goal was to go to a country that is known for its gender violence, known for, just for being an incredibly tough place for human rights, to learn and to try to understand the ingredients necessary for such kind of outspoken gender violence and gender inequity, in hopes that I would then be able to apply that back home, where the same issues are occurring, just often a little bit more buried and a little bit more behind closed doors. And my goal was to learn.
How'd you start that process? Like, you know what I mean? Because I would find it, as I said, pretty intimidating, like just to hit the ground. And what do you do? How do you start?
So Najibullah is totally credited for this. It was like sun up, sun down, meeting all manners of men and women, particularly the women, but men too, who were members of parliament, who were teachers, who were women in prison, women who were self-immolation victims, men and women who were human rights activists themselves, all manners of the social strata, so that it wasn't just one sort of person that I was meeting, so that I could have a really open, clear view of what was happening. And, traveling through the country without security, without, these kind of barriers to human connection that most people in Afghanistan have. I'm traveling as a human in the back of a taxi cab, and that meant that my interactions with Afghans were one-on-one, human-to-human, just like anywhere else in the world. And that meant I was accepted. And I was treated in a very welcoming way, which opened up the doors to build a network over time.
My friend's a scientist. He calls that the data collection stage, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you get all this information. Mm-hmm. You're not going there to be the savior. You're there to learn. Mm-hmm. I think as you think about people who get sort of stuck in becoming activists. Some get stuck because they're overwhelmed by the information about where am I going to start. Some get overwhelmed at this point of like, okay, I went and did this and I've collected all this information. Walk us through how you then took what you'd done in that inquiry process and built it into something.
There probably was a feeling of overload, although I don't really remember the overload, more excitement. But then I'm sure everyone around me was like, how are you going to get all of this done? Because I probably had a gazillion ideas, but that's pretty normal for me. I literally started looking at, well, what are the first impacts that could happen that I could work with and honestly come back to the storytelling? Because the best way to work with Afghans at this point, if I'm going to actually work with them and do anything to help, would be to humanize them. And at that point, and I think even today, we still have a problem humanizing the other. And particularly in a country where we are engaged militarily. We have now shifted to helping Afghans to seeing Afghans lumped in with the Taliban, and they are our enemy in kind of a broad stroke. So I wanted to normalize and humanize them. And I really wanted to highlight what the youth were doing, because they were the great hope of the next generation, educated after the Taliban, exposed to the internet, getting bigger ideas of what is possible in the world. And there were these little sparks of activism. And my first projects were more traditional. They were self-contained ideas and projects that I felt were bite-sized enough that I could take on with Afghans and fundraise for back here and share the stories of. But over time, that quickly evolved into the things that I was most passionate about, which was street art and sport and activism and all the ways that I feel are more revolutionary in a culture, and particularly for women. and so evolve that.
Tell our listeners what that looks like in this project if they don't know, you know, because.
So the first big project around street art was a situation called Streets of Afghanistan. And it's the first life-size street art kind of pop-up outdoor gallery that I created with international and Afghan photographers and brought it to the streets of Afghanistan quite literally and toured it in public spaces as a touring literal pop-up gallery where these images were 10 foot tall by 17 feet across and I could collapse them down and then pop them back up kind of like an accordion wherever we wanted to. We had 40 of these images, so it took a minibus to haul them around Afghanistan. And Afghans thought we were insane when we'd pull up into a public space and start unloading these images and leave them up all day.
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are there permits in
Kabul? Oh my gosh. No, the lawlessness of Afghanistan works in your favor.
Right.
You can, you know, there are times where it is frustrating and there are times where the lawlessness is just a beautiful, beautiful thing. There's no such thing as permitting. There's no such thing as, you know. I did go to the police chief in Kabul and let him know what I was doing and ask him to perhaps lay down a little groundwork when I was going into some new areas. And, you know, would you let them know I'm coming so that, you know, we don't get harassed? And he was pretty cool about it.
So obviously, the question has to be begged that you walked into the lion's den, basically, right? You walked in to perhaps, you know, the actual, you know, mouth of the demon, right? And you just said, here I am, take me. Mm-hmm. And there's gotta be some painful experiences for you while you were doing this. That's kind of the first thing I'd be interested in hearing. Mm-hmm. And then the second question would be like, was this in part catharsis for you being there and having these experiences for what you went through and what your sister went through and, you know, thinking about the future of your daughter?
So the irony is that when I first started working in Afghanistan, I in no way really linked it back to my own experience. Like I didn't make that connection until several years in. Eventually, I was like, oh, light bulb moment. Like, how did I not make that connection? Right. Yeah. In the beginning, I didn't. And part of it was I was so engaged in the culture and in the people. And yes, it is also incredibly dangerous. And there were many, many close calls that I credit having an incredible team of incredible network of expats, journalists, photojournalists, Afghans, where I could ask good questions and try to make good decisions. But every day, practically, you know, there's a suicide bomb, there's a kidnapping attempt, there's something going on. And that is a reality of choosing to work there. And yet, at the same time that you see and feel and are exposed to kind of the worst of humanity, you're also exposed to the best of humanity. And I've never experienced that in literally, you know, every 5 second, 10 second, 30 second intervals that you are juxtaposed with both at the same time. And you fall in love with the country very quickly and the people because of the resiliency of a people who've lived with 4 decades of war and just believe that they just keep going. It wasn't until I started working in the women's prisons that I was really face to face with my own background. Because when I started working in the women's prisons, I was meeting women in prisons all over the country that were predominantly jailed for morality crimes. So they're in jail for the crime of being sexually assaulted. They're in the jail for the crime of being domestically beaten or they've set themselves on fire to escape a bad marriage and they're thrown in jail. And so that's when I really came up really close against the reality of how incredibly lucky I am, because while I was raped and nearly killed and my sister was raped, we were not going to be thrown in jail on, you know, kind of abuse on top of abuse. We were still perceived as quote unquote the victims. There may be a lot of issues around victim blaming in this country, but I've never seen a victim get thrown in jail for that. And so that sparked a lot of introspection and a lot of questions. And I came out of the Kandahar jail, which was a jail that I expected to be the most difficult because it's in Kandahar, which is Taliban controlled as a province. And I had to wear a burqa the entire time I was there so that I could avoid being kidnapped. So it's the most closed that I've ever been traveling around Afghanistan. But I went to the prison expecting it to feel very, you know, closed off, and the women would be very closed off to me. And it ended up being the most engaged that I've ever had an experience in a women's prison, where women literally were coming up to me, pulling on my sleeve to tell me their story, like pouring out of them. And that, in that moment, two things kind of happened. One was, I think it was the first time that I truly understood the power of story and how powerful voice is, that when these are women who no one has ever cared to hear their story. You know, not a judge, not a family member, nobody. And so here, for the first time, someone is coming to them with no other agenda, but I want to hear your story. And I left in tears behind my burqa because I can't do anything for these women. There's literally nothing that I can do. I went in recognizing after the meeting was over, or you know, the day was over, that there wasn't going to be a way for me to work in the prison. That just wasn't a feasible. The commander wasn't going to allow that. And all I had done was feel in that moment that I had taken, and I had been there and taken their time, taken their stories. And it wasn't until days later that I was sitting with all of that I realized that the reason they were pulling on my shirt sleeve, and the reason that they were, you know, lined up like swarming me, was because finally someone was there just to bear witness to their story and how incredibly powerful that is. And that everything that I inherently knew was the thread of my work, but I hadn't made my work, was storytelling and empowering the voice of others. Because often victims, quote unquote, I say victims, are looked upon as less than. And we look upon victims, and we, whether that is, you know, victims of sexual assault or domestic violence or child abuse or, you know, any number of things, or human rights, developing countries, poverty. We look upon victims as something less than, that we have to help and we have to nurture and we need to hold up. And that is demeaning. It's patronizing. People who are victimized and who have to struggle are typically the strongest people that I know. They're the people who have the most resilience. They're the people who have the most capacity to change if we give them the tools, if we allow them to own their own voice and their own story, and to share that so that that comes out of them and isn't just hiding deep inside, like, you know, like a deep, dark secret. And once I kind of had that click into place, then I started being much more vocal about my own story. I hadn't ever been. I wrote my memoir, and I really was much more about empowering, you know, helped support a graffiti art workshop in Afghanistan so that artists understood the power of public street art, using voice through art in a public sphere, which is something I'm very passionate about. And, you know, what are all the ways in which you can empower voice, whether that is in your community, whether that is globally, whether that is individually?
I think we should definitely dive into that idea of how you empower people's voices. But I also am curious, because the street projects and the working in the prison also led to mountain biking.
Yes.
So that's like a pretty cool trail that you took, and you used it as a tool to explore and to break through barriers and promote women's equality and a lot of cool stuff. So how did the mountain biking piece come out of it?
One of those little side divergences in which I saw these goat paths in Afghanistan. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm a mountain biker in Colorado. Why can't I ride these trails in Afghanistan? It's so beautiful. No one realizes how gorgeous it is here. And I happened to be traveling in the north, kind of these northern provinces, with a good friend, and it was springtime, and it's lush and it's green, the flowers are blooming, and there's all these you know, game trails and goat trails. And I mentioned it, and he's like, well, why can't you? I'm like, you're right. Well, why can't I? And so I said, do you really think
a lot of women riding their bikes with like burkas
and spandex?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm trying to figure out the image.
So the funny, well, not so funny, you know, the irony was, is that I had been in Afghanistan 3 times at that point, recognizing that while bikes are everywhere, it was only boys and men that were riding bikes. It was the only place I had been to that point, and I had lived in many countries and in the Middle East before, where there were no women or girls on bikes. And so I decided that I would come back with my mountain bike and use it as a way to explore the question of why. Because I was meeting women who ran for president. I was meeting women who were members of parliament. I was meeting women who wanted to become judges and, you know, all these like groundbreaking, you know, barrier-breaking careers for women and women who were joining the boxing clubs and taekwondo, but bikes were still the last taboo. And every single person I talked to, men, uncles, fathers, you know, brothers, would you let your sister, wife, daughter, you know, ride a bike? Absolutely not. No way.
Car was okay?
Car was okay.
Bike was not?
Yeah, bike was not.
Fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. And I started riding my bicycle in Afghanistan to challenge that barrier because I realized very quickly on in Afghanistan, as a tall, blonde woman that does not look Afghan, you can get away with a lot because they treat you as an honorary man. So my role in Afghanistan was very much this hybrid where I'm treated like a man by the men and allowed the same access that the men have. But because I'm a woman, I have access to the women and I get to go then leave the men and have one-on-one time with the women and undiluted through the perception of what they are worried a man might think or say. So I was in a very unique position. And so I started riding my bicycle in areas where I knew locals in provinces that I knew were relatively safe and landmine cleared and started posing that question. And every single time, the groups of people that gathered or, you know, that I would run into, I was always met with curiosity. I was never met with animosity for being on a bicycle. Hmm. It ended up being the best icebreaker that I could have ever imagined. I had more impromptu, spontaneous conversations with Afghans than I ever would have had or ever have had in any other way because they were caught off guard and you weren't in the structured meeting where you're supposed to have an agenda. It was just like running into somebody, you know, in the corner and, you know, you have something in common or you're curious and you just start, you know, talking about. So I got to share my culture. They'd ask, you know, where I was, who, you know, why was I here? And you start having these one-on-one conversations that then would lead to invitations for tea or dinner, you know, whatever.
And would people jump in and ride with you?
Yes. I ended up riding with a lot of boys, a lot of men. We'd swap bikes often, which disc brakes do not translate well. So there's a lot of crashes, a lot of over the head when they'd squeeze my brakes because typically their brakes didn't work.
Right.
So I would be squeezing their brakes to no avail. They'd squeeze mine and flip over. And then have the question, would you ever allow your daughter to ride a bike? Would you ever allow your wife to ride a bike? And the question still was no. I'm sorry, the answer still was no. And the response would be, but it's your culture. It's not ours. And I just kept riding in different parts of the country. Every single time I would go back, I'd come with my bicycle, ask questions, use it as an icebreaker, but go about my normal work, quote unquote. And then 5 years later, I met the first girls to ever ride bikes in Afghanistan, and everything changed again.
Is that where the strength in numbers comes from?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So I met the first generation of women, which, I mean, at that point, I say generation, 5 girls who were riding bicycles in Kabul as part of the Afghan national cycling team. And it came about because photojournalist living in Kabul who rode his bike knew about me and said, I've met a boy who's part of the men's national team. He is so excited to meet you. He's a waiter at this cafe. You know, I told him you're going to come by tomorrow. Go see him. So I went and met with him. He invited me to go for a ride with the men's national team, which I had no idea there was a men's cycling team. You know, literally Afghan young men in spandex. Never seen them, never heard of them. No story had ever been done on them before. Yeah, it was crazy. So met with them on the north side of Kabul at a petrol station. We're going to go ride the highway. And their coach comes driving up to meet them there. And there's a woman with him. And turns out that this woman, who I thought was his assistant, was also a member of the women's cycling team. And the coach was training not just men, but women. And at that moment, I was like, nope, I'm not going for a bike ride. I'm going to stay right here and talk with you, and the boys can go for a ride, and I want to know more about this women's team. And that was the start of working with the first generation of girls to ride bikes. 5 years later, 6 years later now, because that was the fall of 2014. 2012. Yeah, that was the fall of 2012, so 6 years ago. There's a national cycling team. There's another racing team in another province called Bamiyan. There's been multiple iterations of girls' bike clubs. So hundreds of girls have learned to ride bikes. So there literally has been this start of a burgeoning revolution on two wheels of girls riding bikes. And they do it risking their lives. I mean, they risk their lives. They risk their honor. They have rocks thrown at them. They are targeted. They do this with an enormous amount of risk. They are insulted. They're told they're dishonorable girls, but that doesn't stop them. You know, they know they're part of changing culture, and they refuse to be told that this is not something that they can do. They see that girls all over the world do this and recognize that, you know, no one can tell us we can't do this.
So it's really interesting, because it's like we talked about apathy, right? Mm-hmm. In the face of these big forces. Well, you know, and then you talked about Afghanistan being such a resilient people, mm-hmm. and then these women now not being apathetic, but getting rocks thrown at them and expressing amazing resiliency.
Yeah.
Now, so it's like they're more resilient, right? Do you think that drop of water theory that you talked mm-hmm. about is actually happening? Or do you personally sometimes get discouraged? You know what I mean? Where like, oh, it's just not happening enough, or maybe it's two steps forward and three steps back, you know?
Well, I would say yes to both of those questions. Yes, I think that the drop of water is happening, and that I definitely see that. And yes, I get discouraged. My discouragement comes usually because it's not happening fast enough, or that there's corruption, or that there is the risks inherent with the work. And it's so incredibly difficult. But at the same time, this is a country in which we're watching, women risk their lives to create change because they believe it is their right, that no one should be able to tell them no. And that they have seen that generations of women before them in other countries have gone through the same thing. And we've talked about what happened in America and in England when women started riding a bike at the turn of the century. It was intrinsically linked with the suffragette movement.
Yeah.
And women, when they started riding bikes, were told that they were immoral and promiscuous. American women were immoral and promiscuous because they dared to ride a bike.
There might have been some rocks thrown at them.
There might have been some rocks thrown at them. Exactly. Yeah.
So you make that connection with your girls, with the women.
I do. Yeah. I've taught.
So they understand. They have a perspective of like, hey, this is, you're in a dynamic, like crazy part of history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You are one piece of this. That while it feels like you are alone in this and that you're very isolated, one, look around the region. There are pockets of girls in India and Iran and Pakistan, that are riding, that are, you know, a few generations past where you're at, but that are still threatened or still looked upon, you know, as dishonorable. But there's more of them. So culturally, that is happening and shifting. But that, you know, in the long stretch of time since there was a bicycle, that the bike has always been an intrinsic part of almost every culture's women's rights movement. And that if you look at that systemically, don't forget that then you are actually part of history going forward.
That's powerful.
Yeah, that's some pioneering shit right there.
So I'd love to bring it back to this, where we started around endangered activism, because clearly from this conversation, you are the type of individual who sees a problem and says, I want to go figure out how I can help, right? For a lot of our listeners, I think they might not see, they couldn't imagine themselves to be that way. A lot of us can't, right? Like, I'm not someone, you know, you might think of yourself as like, I can go do that, but it's hard, right? The work is hard to make that happen. And I think that can lead to the apathy too. So we do a lot of work with kids at No Barriers, middle and high school kids. We work with adults who want to make a difference, but don't know where to start. So what's your advice for folks who maybe aren't inclined like you are to just jump up and do it? How do you propel those folks forward?
And I wouldn't advise everybody to go the path that I've done, you know, for sure. It's really, for me, I think that the important thing is that for me, this feels natural. Like, this doesn't feel like a radical step. None of it does. It may sound like that to someone who isn't comfortable in those things, but for me, it's never felt radical. I think it's about really recognizing, like, what are your skill sets? Like, what do you love? Like, what do you like? I love street art. I love storytelling. I love not doing the same thing every day. So hence, write a book, try to teach myself how to become a producer on a film, you know, street art and other forms of storytelling and creating new projects, because I need that sort of creative stimulation. So I think that it's about, what are the skills that you bring to the table in your daily life? What are the ways in which you get excited to engage in your community? And then how do you help that way? You know, whether that may be, you know, is that coaching in sports? Is that looking at what, you know, community issues there are around that need your, you know, your support? Is that getting involved in local politics, because the broader big politics frustrates you? Well, then running for local office is totally doable. And how do you affect change in your direct community? I think that's where we're coming back to, because we can always look at pointing the finger and saying, oh, look, you know, there's horrible human rights issues in, you know, Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan or, you know, wherever. There's sex trafficking in Cambodia and Vietnam. There's, you know, we can pick any problem. We have all those same problems here. Denver is a major sex trafficking hub. We have major human trafficking problems in the U.S. We have domestic violence. We have sexual violence. We have poverty issues. We have, you know, refugee problems that we need to support. And so how do we plug into those issues that are all in our local community?
People probably, like, because I know I personally feel unqualified and ill-equipped for the big missions ahead sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, was that part of your experience? Did you, when you, you know, went to Afghanistan, when you started all these projects, do mm-hmm. you, is that a natural feeling, or is that just me?
No, I think it's a supernatural feeling. But again, I think it was, I was always choosing to, one, be really open to surrounding myself with people who knew more than me, right, and always listening, always trying to learn, and then contributing what I knew best, and trying to plug the gaps of where I thought, okay, this is what I bring to the table. This is what my skill set is, versus I'm going to come in and do everything.
Right. It sounds like you're very comfortable with that feeling of being vulnerable. And
I am now.
Yeah.
I didn't start out that way. I've learned, this has been a big learning curve for me, in that I think that I grew up, and I think probably a lot of people do, thinking that your strength is your biggest strength. And what I slowly, after working in Afghanistan, came to learn was that my vulnerability was my biggest strength. And that was a massive turning point for me. It's so hard, because you're super exposed and you feel like, okay, well, like, I don't have anything protecting me. If my vulnerability is my biggest strength and that's where I'm going to lead from, what's going to keep me safe? But what you recognize is that actually, your vulnerability exposed, people around you step up and help, you know, and help carry the burden with you, you're more authentic, you're more trustworthy, you know, because you're leading from a place that's real versus when you are leading thinking that your strength is your strength and there's an armor around you and nobody actually really gets in. And I don't think that you build the same coalitions and the same partnerships and the same camaraderie that you do. But we are taught that we have to be strong. Resiliency is right. What we want, you know, and resiliency, I guess, I shouldn't say that because resiliency is good, but we are taught that strength is what we should be striving for. And I disagree.
Well, to bring it back to your personal story, I mean, so you're sexually assaulted, you almost die, you know, so you would think you would put that armor around you and you'd close down, you know, that's a very natural response, but it seems like you did the opposite. And do you think that those things are linked somehow, like Jeff was asking earlier, or do you think you would have done all this stuff despite anything?
No. I had a really tough conversation with my best friend in the Heathrow Airport coming back from a trip from Afghanistan, where I'd had a journalist with me for 3 weeks, which was horrible experience, just in terms of feeling completely exposed, everything being documented. And, but I came out of it and I'm calling her from Heathrow, you know, I'm out of Afghanistan, I'm on my way home. And I said, I don't really have this thought fully formed yet in my head, but I need to run this by you because I think that I've just cracked something open in that I don't forgive the person who assaulted me. I'm never going to thank him in that respect, but I would not be the person that I am had I not been assaulted. And there is a very strange thread that now connects us because of that. And I like who I am. You know, I am proud of the work that I do. I am proud of the mother that I am. I'm proud of the good that I'm trying to do in the world and of the mistakes I've made. I'm even proud of those, but I probably would not be living the life that I am had that not happened. And
one of those
that's a hard thing to admit.
Contradictions, you know, in this life map, right?
Yeah. And it's essentially reconciling that, you know, the things that happen to us that we see as, you know, as the worst, you know, the worst of the worst are also the catalyst for change in us that can be the best of us.
You can relate to that, right, Dub?
I can't relate to that at all.
Well, there's only, I don't think everybody's equipped to do, especially, you know, in different venues, what you two have done. You've taken a pretty, you know, challenging world flipping experience and then using it as fuel and as momentum. And even though, Shannon, like you, maybe it didn't occur to you, right? And like immediately, obviously, but years later, you had this epiphany like, wait a minute, okay, now I get it, right? And all the while, you had been doing this thing, right? You had, it just didn't occur to you. And is that fair to say?
Yeah, well, because I never, you know, until someone says why, you just do what you do. Like, until someone questions you and you have to actually justify why you're doing what you do, you don't think about the reasons. Mm-hmm. You're just living your life, doing what you do, making the choices that feel right and trying to go about your business. So it wasn't until, honestly, it was a Dateline NBC story with Ann Curry. She was asking me why. She said, why, you know, so, you know, why do you do this? And I had no answer. And I had this
I hate that question.
Yeah, it's horrible, right?
Ann Curry's asked you that question once before.
And you're like, it's a super, she bores into you with, you know, this stare and she like doesn't let you off the hook. And you're like, I don't know. I had a super trite answer. I said something like, because if I don't do it, nobody will or something so stupid. It was just ridiculous. And she knew it. And I don't know. No one had ever asked me and not let me off the hook. So then I'm like, oh, God, I don't know. And it was then literally on camera for that interview that I recognized that that was my reasoning.
Yeah. Can I follow this up, though? This is an interesting thing that if I'm a listener, I want to know. I know this wasn't an easy path for you, but it sounds like you're just this badass woman who just took this and just went in and you made it just, it's so easy. You just, because you've just got you and your character. There's a lot of people like I said, who I don't think have, or at least they don't think they have, the ability to take this lemon lemonade sort of deal. So what would be, as if you had to really kind of wrap it up, how would you tell those people who have had these events in whatever facet, in whatever venue, to take that and then turn it and use it as fuel? And I know that's a very, very hard question, but if I could pull that out of you in some way.
Well, no, it's a really good question, because you're right. I mean, we're talking about what has happened. And so it's easy to talk about, like, okay, so here's the trajectory. We have a limited amount of time and rah, rah, rah. But it took, you know, 20 years. And it doesn't mean that there's, you know, not your dear friends whose couches I go and cry on and say, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to bear the weight of this. Or I don't know how to do this anymore. I don't know, you know, and choosing the life that I've chosen as a creative, as an activist, you know, has zero security. You know, I'm raising a daughter with no security, financial security, not to mention physical security, but financial security. There's no umbrella for that. So there's an enormous amount of fear to manage. And there's also a lot of other people's doubt to manage and not to somehow let that seep in. Because while I feel that I'm taking off bite-sized pieces that I can be excited about creating, that doesn't mean that other people around you are not saying, you can't do this, you shouldn't do this, why are you doing this? Especially as a mother, you know, as a single mother, co-parenting her daughter, you shouldn't go to Afghanistan. You shouldn't have such an unstable career. You shouldn't talk so openly about X, Y, or Z. And it's very hard to stay true to that, you know, that inner compass that says, no, this is exactly what I should be doing. Just because I'm a mother doesn't mean I change my trajectory. I want her to follow her trajectory. Mm. So therefore I have to live by mine. So she sees that as a model. And so I think that really what it is recognizing that I didn't go from 18 years old, raped and nearly killed, to now having accomplished what I've accomplished overnight, that it took bite-sized steps along the way and, a lot of reflection, a lot of working to surround myself with good people who knew more than me all the time.
Well, where can our listeners go to learn more about your latest work?
The latest work would be at endangeredactivism.org. That would be the project with myself and my daughter, which is really where a lot of the focus is right now.
But your memoir too, right? Mountain to Mountain? Is that right?
Thank you, yes. Yeah. The memoir Mountain to Mountain is out for a couple of years, and that definitely kind of details the trajectory of becoming an activist and answers maybe some of those questions as to the ups and downs and how that came to be. And then there's a movie, Afghan Cycles, that just came out, which has been a five-year production documenting the first generation of girls in Afghanistan. That's now in the film festival circuit. So,
well, thank you so much, Shannon, for joining us and sharing some insights that I think we can all learn from. One of the principles we teach at No Barriers is the idea of elevate, which is your life needs to be about more than just yourself. You need to go out and do something for others. And I think your life embodies that spirit. And so it's been an honor to talk to you, and thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. This has been amazing.
God, I mean, what do you say? Like, that was, you're an amazing human being, and thank you for being on this planet and doing what you do. You got a heart of service. It's good. You make it better.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, guys, what a journey that was.
I feel like I'm a little exhausted.
I know, right? I mean, it's like
it makes you fired up all at the same time.
Right. Yeah. It's like, gosh, I got to go out and do more. Right? You know. So, what did you all hear that kind of bubbled to the surface for you?
Me for art. I'm always first.
You're the most handsome.
Well, Shannon talked about, you know, just starting a process, feeling vulnerable and then collecting data, you know, the inquiry phase, and then And then trying to sort that information, trying to figure out how you can make an impact in the world and something that you can do, you know? So I think what she was laying out was kind of a little bit of a recipe for activism. And I think that's really important for people because I'm into recipes, I'm into maps, like something that you can take away from it. And I think she gave us a lot of good information on how you could actually go out and do this thing or something that is important to you that you're totally overwhelmed by.
Yeah, because that was the thing that really was fascinating. I think about her and her storyline and how it all came to be. And, you know, I wonder if she is obviously extraordinary, but is she just that extraordinary or does everybody have that and can sort of pull from that? And that was the thing that really hit me. Here's this, you know, this human being that basically, you know, just said, okay, I've had this experience and now, whether I know it externally or not, my soul wants to go in and just sort of face it and figure out a way to turn that into something that's really positive and impact the world in such a profound way. So, yeah, I agree, Eric. It's that sort of playbook that I don't know if I've ever heard it laid out like that before. So really remarkable. And I sure hope everybody enjoyed that as much as I did. Dave, what do you got?
Yeah, I think one of the quotes I've been using in some recent programming at No Barriers is a Nietzsche quote that says, "He who has a why to live for can endure any how." And some of that last part of our conversation about once you find that why and that thing you care the most about, no matter how hard what you face is, and she was talking about how she faced many difficult things as she was going through these projects, she finds that energy in the why, you know, and I think that's so much at the root of what we talk about is find that why. What's that purpose for you? Because that's the fuel that'll get you through the hardest of heart. Well, thank you guys. Been another great discussion. For those of you who are listening, if you enjoyed the conversation, please like and share this podcast with others. That's one of the greatest things you can do to help out No Barriers. You can learn more about No Barriers at nobarriersusa.org. You can take our new virtual learning course that walks you through how to break through the adversities in your own life. You can sign up for programs for yourself, your families, your kids, and folks that you know that might benefit from the kinds of experiences that we provide. So thank you all for a great conversation.
All right. No barriers.
Right on.
Thanks to all of you for listening to our podcast. We know that you have a lot of choices about how you can spend your time, and so we appreciate you spending it with us. If you enjoy this podcast, we encourage you to subscribe to it, share it, and give us a review. Show notes can be found at nobarrierspodcast.com. Special thanks to the Dan Ryan Band for our intro song, which is called Guidance. The production team behind this podcast includes producers Diedrich Jonk and Pauline Schaefer, sound design, editing, and mixing by Jesse Singer and Tyler Kottman, graphics by Sam Davis, and marketing support by Laura Baldwin and Jamie Donnelly. Thanks to all you amazing people for the great work you do. They will be fighting.